Today in Studio 360, Herb Alpert's Latin-flavored, almost proto-disco records changed American music, and then he changed the music business. When he founded A&M Records in the 1960s and released his first album, he got a call from his distributor.
And he said, "Herbie, how fast can you send me 104,000 albums? We're selling a lot of tonnage." I mean, that was the first time I thought of music reduced to weight.
I don't want your lonely mansion with the...
And I'll talk with another much-loved American singer with actual Mexican ancestry who helped bring Mexican music into the mainstream. And in the process, sold a tonnage of records herself, Linda Ronstadt.
I thought that Spanish was the language you sang in and English is what you spoke.
That and more is ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
Studio 360 is supported by TiVo, unifying cable, on-demand, and streaming apps like Netflix without the need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or user experience. Learn more at TiVo.com. And by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360, and I am Kurt Anderson.
Glory, glory.
On today's show, I'll talk with the writer James McBride. His most recent novel is about American slavery, but purely grim and serious, it is not.
I like to laugh, and I like to read stuff that makes me laugh, and I don't want to write a book that's depressing.
My conversation with him is later this hour. First, in the mid-1960s, I was into the music my teenage older siblings liked, like the Beatles and the Stones. But I also listened to my parents' albums by Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass. That loungy, jazzy, James Bondy pseudo-Latino music spoke to a boy of 11 going on 12. And as the decades went on, Herb Alpert kept producing hits. It's hard to overstate Alpert's influence on pop music. Apart from his own hits, he co-founded a major record label, A&M, and launched lots of big careers, from the Carpenters to the Police. Herb Alpert is now 79, and he's got a new record, his 40th, called In the Mood, which he's backing with a nationwide tour. When we spoke back in 2012, he told me his career began all because he had trouble speaking up as a kid.
You know, I was very lucky in my grammar school. They had a music appreciation class, and there were a bunch of instruments on a table. And I happened to pick out the trumpet, and I tried to make some sound out of it, and I couldn't, which intrigued me. And I was very, very shy as a young kid. So when I finally did make noise out of it, it was speaking for me.
And did you do more than just the songs they make you play in school bands? Were you, like, picking up jazz riffs?
I'm fortunate I have very good relative pitch, so if I hear a song on the radio, I can just play it right back. And I don't know how it happens. I just seem to press the right valves.
So you were suddenly the Charlie Parker of your set?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. No, I was, you know, I have a very classical background. When I was going to USC, I was playing in the orchestra there, and they were playing Pictures at an Exhibition by Mussorgsky that was arranged by Ravel. And I got so enamored with the sound of the orchestra, I was leaning forward. I was in the back row with the trumpet section. I was leaning forward, listening to this thing, and it sounded, I said, "Man, that's great. It sounds like stereo or something. You know, it's just a beautiful sound." And I forgot to come in. I forgot to play my part. So right from that point, I just said, "Hey, you know something? I'm not that interested in playing other people's music. I want to close my eyes and just, you know, invent my own thing."
How interesting, though, that this classic romantic piece, Mussorgsky and Ravel, that seems right for Herb Alpert to have sort of lost his mind over.
Well, it certainly washed over me, and I'm a big fan of Ravel. I love his, you know, his drama. There's something about but the way he orchestrated that really touched me. You know, little by little, I was looking for my own voice. I was drafted in the Army in 1954, And they sent me to band school in Fort Knox, Kentucky.
And no war going on, fortunately.
No, that was very fortunate. So I go to band school in Fort Knox, Kentucky, and I run into like 12 trumpet players that were, they were better than me, man.
Really?
Oh, yeah. They could play higher, faster, louder, better jazz. You know, they were just something that really made me think, if I'm ever going to make it in this music industry, I better come up with my own identity. And that's what I worked on when I was released.
And you were also working on being a producer. I mean, you helped discover Sam Cooke and Janet Dean.
I didn't discover Sam Cooke. I was working for the company along with Lou Adler. Lou Adler and I were partners, and we worked for this Keen Records and became really good friends with Sam. We wrote A Wonderful World with him. Don't Know Much About History, that song. And I learned a lot from Sam because he came out of the gospel field. You know, everything had to do with a feel. It had to feel good. It had to feel good, you know.
Was that a meaningful thing for you? I mean, as a producer, did you then try to say, okay, I think I know what he means and try to feel it?
Well, he used to say, Herbie, it's a cold piece of wax, man. It either makes it or it don't.
I hold you responsible for so much of my youth. Tell me the story behind the song that made me hear of you when I was 7 or 8 years old for the first time, The Lonely Bull, which we would play over and over and over again.
Yeah. Well, you know, I used to go to bullfights in Tijuana for several years during the spring. They had world-class matadors there, and I kind of got, I became a fan of that.
You would drive down from Southern California?
Drive down from Los Angeles. And there was this brass band in the stands that would announce all the sequence of events. People in the stands would go crazy. And I was kind of taken by that. I liked that feeling. And the more I drank wine out of my boat bag, the better I liked it. There was something about that feeling that I thought maybe I could translate it into a sound. And then I played it for a disc jockey friend of mine, and he said, man, you need some hooks. You got to put a hook in there. I said, what do you mean a hook? He says, well, something that people can remember. So an engineer friend of mine, Ted Keeps, had a tape of 30,000 people screaming ole at a bullfight. I put that on right in the front of the Lonely Bull. And months later, I would get cards and letters from people all over the world saying, thanks for taking me on this vicarious trip to Tijuana.
No, since it didn't really belong in any existing pop category, were you surprised when it became this gigantic hit record?
Yeah, I was taken off guard for sure. Yeah, I didn't think it was going to start a record company. This was the first record we released on A&M. This was A&M 101. And that was the start of...
And you were A of A&M.
I was the A, and that was the start of something really grand.
And then, when I was 11 years old and playing the trumpet in Omaha, Nebraska, came your gigantic album, Whipped Cream.
Right.
1965. And I was just the right age to spend hours staring at the cover because it was a naked girl, apparently naked girl, covered in whipped cream. And I played the trumpet, and there was all this trumpet was kind of cool suddenly on this record. So you'd been doing Tijuana Brass for a while, but that took it to a new stratosphere.
Well, it did take it to a new level, and... you know, there was no Tijuana Brass group.
There was you.
Yeah, it was a sound that I created while overdubbing my horn on top of my horn, basically up through the Whipped Cream and Other Delights album. And that girl, Dolores Erickson, who was the model on the Whipped Cream cover, she was 3 months pregnant. And also she was covered in shaving cream.
So we couldn't have eaten it. So Tijuana Brass plays entirely instrumentals at a time when singer, songwriter, rock and roll is just coming in. You were like the first pop musical brand creator. I mean, it was, you know, I mean, it, really, this band, which, by the way, had no Hispanics in it, playing this Latinish music, is suddenly everywhere. I even remember on the dating game.
It's the dating game. And here's the star of our show and your host.
Did you ever worry? Did that worry you, or was getting the royalties good enough?
Worry me about in what sense?
Well, that your music was being reduced to sort of goofy game show theme music.
Oh, I didn't think about it. I couldn't believe all the airplay we were getting and the amount of records we were selling. I mean, there was an experience I had. My partner, there was just the two of us when we started A&M, and my partner, Jerry Moss, one time he got a call from our distributor, and he said, "Herbie, how fast can you send me 104,000 albums?" I said, "You're kidding. You need 104,000. I says, "You must really like this record." He says, "I never heard it, but we're selling a lot of tonnage." I mean, that was the first time I thought of music.
How flattering.
Reduced to weight.
So A&M Records, your label with Jerry Moss, is growing and growing. What acts are you proudest of signing?
Well, I guess the Carpenters, because, yeah. I mean, they were the biggest act we had. I mean, there was something about them that I liked very much when I heard the tape. I heard this tape sitting in my office at A&M, and I had two speakers on the floor, and I was sitting on my couch about 10 feet away from the speakers, closing my eyes, which Sam Cooke taught me to do, by the way. So I closed my eyes, I was listening to this tape, and it felt like Karen Carpenter's voice was sitting right next to me. Her voice is projected right out of the speakers.
Why do birds suddenly appear?
It wasn't the type of music that I would normally listen to, but there was something about them that I really loved.
Just like me, they long to be close to you.
And then the first album that was released by the Carpenters didn't sell at all. I mean, it was like a turkey, as they say.
And this, by the way, is what, 1970?
Yeah, 1970.
So here we have over here Jimi Hendrix and Cream, and here's the Carpenters.
Yeah. The Carpenters didn't sell, and then people in my own company were looking at me like, "Why did you sign these goods?" You know, I mean, if they're too soft, they can't happen. And Karen was playing drums at the time. And I heard the recording, and I said, "This is too soft. We got to put a little energy on this."
So they sprinkle moon dust in your hair, and golden starlight in your eyes are blue. That is why all the girls come south.
And so they did, and "Close You" was the door opener for them. And you know, after They zoomed through that door and started selling millions of records. You know, people in my own company were looking at me like, "Man, the guy's not too bad.
He's still got it."
Yeah.
Then the next time I remember hearing you as musician as opposed to you as record executive was, I guess, 1979 with the song Rise, which was a disco hit.
Well, it wasn't exactly a disco hit because it happened because my nephew, Randy Alpert, who goes under the name of Captain Badass, by the way, wrote the song with his buddy, Andy Armour, and they wanted me to do the Tijuana Brass records in disco, you know, with the boom, 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 120 beats per minute. I gave it a shot. We went in the studio and started fooling around with Taste of Honey in a disco beat, and I just couldn't handle it. I got nauseous. Quite frankly, I did.
Really?
Well, I just felt like, geez, why trample on it? These songs are already hits, and they were good. Let's just leave them. I had some studio time left, and they had this song called Rise, and they wanted to do it as boom, 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 120 beats per minute. I said, "Look, let's just slow this thing down to 100 beats per minute so people, after they're dancing apart, can get together and dance, you know, a little more romantically." So we did that, and it became a big hit. Ah, yeah, that's that bass line.
There it is.
That's been copied many times.
Well, not only copied, but then had a whole new life 20 years later in Biggie's.
Yeah, it did.
B.I.G.'s song, Hypnotize.
Hypnotize, and it was a big, big, big record.
Don't think.
when you first heard it sampled and looped and used in a hip-hop hit that way, what did you think? Like, I've been around too long? This is, I'm in some loop?
You know something, to tell you the truth, to be quite honest, I'm not crazy about when artists take someone else's material and uses it. That means they can't think for themselves, you know? I'm not regretting that he did it, you know.
Yeah.
It was a big hit record, and it was a good record, too.
And you must have done okay with the fees they pay you for sampling that. A lot of jazz musicians would count themselves lucky.
Well, yeah, I think so. You know how you make $1 million playing jazz, by the way? You start with $3 million. Bada-boom, bada-boom.
Herb Albert, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Herb Albert's latest album with his wife Lonnie Hall is called In the Mood, and it'll be out at the end of September. You can see a slideshow of all of his very groovy record covers on our website, studio360.org. Coming up, Linda Ronstadt stole the hearts of a generation, but it didn't come easy.
It takes a long time to learn to do anything well. And I took about 10 years to learn how to sing.
Feeling better now that we're through.
Linda Ronstadt's ahead this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
I learned my lesson and left a scar.
Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by TiVo. No need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or interfaces to access cable TV and streaming from Netflix and Hulu Plus. Learn more at TiVo.com. And by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
You're listening to Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Linda Ronstadt is one of the most beloved singers of the baby boom generation. In fact, when President Obama gave her the National Medal of Arts last month, he leaned in and told her that he had a little crush on her as a boy. I feel you, Mr. President.
And I've been kicked by the wind, robbed by the sleet, had my head stolen, but I'm still on my feet and I'm still willing.
Ronstadt has sold more than 100 million records, and really, her popularity has endured because she's so good, but also because she's so good at switching up styles. Rock and roll, country, then operetta and mariachi. This spring, Linda Ronstadt was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and her memoir, Simple Dreams, is coming out in paperback this fall. I spoke with her last year, just a few weeks after she'd announced that her singing days are done. Linda Ronstadt, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you so much for having me.
The case you make in the book is that the range of music you were exposed to as a kid in the 1950s, I guess, and early 60s, was sort of a well you kept drawing from for your whole career. I want to play this Mexican ballad that you apparently learned as a girl.
El cañal está en su punto. Hoy comienza la molienda. El trapiche está de duelo y suspira en cada vuelta.
So you actually seem moved once again these years later hearing yourself sing that.
Well, it's not me. It's the music. It's the song. You know, that's a beautiful, beautiful song about a huapanguero. The huapango is a certain kind of Mexican song that's you hear in the mountains. It's where you break into a thrilling kind of soaring yodel. And there's certain people that can really do it well, and they're revered, you know, in the culture. That song talks about a mill turning around to grind the sugar cane, and the Rogaciano, this thrilling singer, has died, and everyone's in mourning, and the whole entire countryside, even the mill, when it moves around, it sighs, you know, every time it makes a revolution. You know, it's a beautiful, beautiful, rich song. I love it.
And growing up in Arizona and having Spanish songs as part of your...
Mexican songs,
Spanish language songs. Was there something, as you heard songs like that as a kid, that made you say, I can do that, or I really, really want to do that?
I always wanted to do that. And when we were kids, everybody in my family sang in Spanish and English. You know, everybody was bilingual completely, except for me. And I thought that Spanish was a language you sang in, and English was what you spoke. But if there was a party or some kind of a celebration, you know, the guitars would come out and people would start singing in two languages, and we'd crawl up into somebody's lap and fall asleep with this wonderful male voices in my family, all rich, beautiful, deep baritone voices.
And speaking of going to bed and going to sleep to music, I in the book, I love the songs that you say your mother and father would sing to you at bedtime. They are really, really dark, like some Roald Dahl murder ballad.
Aren't they?
Yeah, I wish.
My parents were so nice.
I mean, Leave It to Beaver never had songs like this. If you could maybe just read
some. Yeah, that
wasn't
the truth. Nobody believed that stuff, really.
Some of the lyrics of the one your mom sang?
She'd sing, "Last night my darling baby died. She died committing suicide. Some say she died despite us of spinal meningitis. She was a nasty baby anyway."
So not only grotesque and mean, but funny.
We sang back to her, "Oh, don't go in the cage tonight, mother darling, for the lions are ferocious and may bite. And when they get their angry fits, they may tear you all to bits. So don't go in the lion's cage tonight."
And was
in
it
harmony, we would sing this
in
story.
Spanish?
In English.
In English.
Yeah.
Instead of being a purely idyllic childhood, that gives it a nice edge.
Well, my father would sing to us a beautiful song that he learned from his mother from northern Mexico. It was called Arriba en el cielo se vive un coyote con ojos de plata y los pies de azogue. Up in the sky there lives a coyote with silver eyes and feet of mercury. Kill it for a thief. From underneath the floor there goes a rat. Kill it with a stake.
And was this just...
Very soothing.
I mean, what was it about them that chose to present you, darling little Linda, with these...
Well,
songs.
Maybe parents just get so desperate they'll threaten you with anything. If you don't shut up, the rat's going to come and get you, you know. I don't know. The coyote with the quicksilver eyes, that's a lovely image. I thought
totally.
That was nice.
In the book, you kind of skip the point where you get your big break, or maybe you didn't get one big break and it was instead a gradual process.
It was kind of like that,
in your early 20s. But when it was happening in the late 60s, was that scary? Were you self-conscious about performing, about being famous?
I was pretty self-conscious about not being very good yet. You know,
really?
I think that it takes a long time to learn to do anything well. And I took about 10 years to learn how to sing. I mean, I was just really kind of wandering around in the dark trying to copy.
Really? So until 1976, you couldn't really sing?
I didn't really think so. And really, maybe not until after 1980 was when I really got going. Yeah.
So there you were, Linda Ronstadt, and you really felt, did at the time in 1977, you feel like, I'm not really all I should be?
I thought that very strongly, and I wanted to do more, and I wanted to do stuff that was a very custom fit, not only to my voice, but to my sensibility, you know. And I grew up with this wacky background in the desert, you know, it's not like everybody else. And I grew up bicultural. A lot of the songs that I'd heard when I was a child, I thought were better songs than some of the mainstream pop things, a lot of the mainstream pop things that I was getting. I thought they were better. I wanted to do them.
You talk in the book about this turning point when you see Emmylou Harris for the first time and you are hugely impressed with her talent and make this conscious decision to like her. I'm going to like her even though I'm jealous of her great ability. I'm going to play you singing with Emmylou and Dolly Parton, "Do I Ever Cross Your Mind?"
I never have been very competitive in terms of art. I think competition is a good thing for a horse race. But I think that she was doing what I was doing, exactly what I was trying to do. And she, in my opinion, she was doing it much better. And I think she still does. But you know what?
Although she only, to be fair, was only doing one part of all of the things.
Yeah, but I hadn't done all those other things yet. And I was chasing country rock at the time. And Chris Hillman had told me that he was sure we were going to like each other. He had such respect for Emmy. And I knew I was going to like her. It was something very extraordinary that happened up on that stage that night. I already loved her. So I thought, I can love her and I can be jealous and it'll spoil every note I ever hear that she sings. Or I can just love her and just admire and step back and admire. And maybe I'll get to sing with her.
And it worked out.
So she was busy singing with Graham at the time. But, you know, eventually I got to sing with her. Best decision I ever made, by
really?
The way, emotionally.
Did it last beyond Emmylou Harris? And did it, like...
With everything else I've ever encountered like that. I mean, it was just a huge... I never was particularly afflicted of the green-eyed monster, but that was a time I just told it to f*** off, you know?
I was interested that as you moved to these bigger and bigger venues and were playing arenas and kind of hated them and hated the sound and hated the aesthetic of that performative experience.
Yeah.
That's when you said, okay, I'm going to sing opera. I'm going to do Gilbert and Sullivan. Well,
that was operetta.
I know.
I wanted to be.
But La Boheme, opera.
The Greeks had it right, you know, when they designed the proscenium stage. A theater is there to give you an experience of magical reality. And there are a lot of processes that change your mind. You know, you walk in and you're in the entryway there in the lobby, and already you've made a deliberate attempt to separate yourself from the people on the street that are going to do whatever, and you're going to go see this show. So if you're in a real theater, it's like a machine to get people to pay attention to you. Now, if you're in one of those sporting arenas, people are out buying a beer, they're buying a hot dog, they're passing a joint, they're checking out what their girlfriend's wearing.
Watching the moon, yeah.
Yeah, anything. You have to struggle hard. And now, I just wanted to sing in a real theater with a curtain. Isn't that stupid?
No.
I wanted a curtain and a proscenium.
Really? It wasn't. It
wasn't a sound system.
But it was
lights.
All that. But I'm sure. But wasn't it kind of a stubborn, I can't be pigeonholed. I can do this, too. And I can do this, too.
And I just wanted to do something that was really good, you know, that was people really listened and you were really doing it, like you were really on stage doing it right.
Was there anything – I mean, you tried so many different things and these – really? Linda Ronstadt's doing that? Really? Linda Ronstadt's doing that? Was there ever anything you wanted to do that you just didn't get to in that sense?
I was just thinking about that in the car on the way over. I wish I could have sung Kurt Vile until it came out my ears. I love – oh, God. I love Songs from the Threepenny Opera. I love Mahogany. I love September Song. Oh, God, I want to sing September Song, and I can't sing.
When you started talking last month about how you have been diagnosed with Parkinson's and apparently have had it for some years, you said, and you can't sing, and you haven't been able to sing for years. What does that mean, that you can't sing to your satisfaction? You can sing better than I can, no doubt.
No, I can't sing at all. The muscles – see, Parkinson's particularly affects your muscles.
Right.
There's nothing wrong with the muscles, but there's a guy, you know, sitting in your brain, you know, making a phone call to the muscle saying, move in this certain exquisite way. I can't get to the note. It's like taking the elevator. You push 9, you go to 13, you know. You know, eventually you freeze with Parkinson's disease.
Yeah. Do you want to be involved in music if you can't sing or?
Well, I am involved in music because a big part of it is hearing. I mean, music is 99% hearing. And the other 1%, it's like visual art. It's 99% seeing and the rest is what you can draw. I'm involved with a group in Northern California in the East Bay called Los Ensondles. And I've been involved with them for 20-plus years, and they do an amazing job in a little strip mall of teaching children, mostly immigrants' children, traditional Mexican music, and these children come out really knowing how to use music for their life.
So before I let you go, I want you to choose which of your songs that we should play you out on. Which is the best one that people should leave this conversation hearing?
Well, I think maybe I'd like to play the last thing I ever recorded as a solo artist. I had learned to recraft my singing voice at that point. I was kind of doing the best I could with what I had. I had found a different way to tell a story. And it's a song that is a record that I made with John Boylan, who was there in the beginning. We sort of came around full circle. It's called Just Tell Him I Said Hello.
That it shall be. Linda Ronstadt, thank you very, very much.
Thank you for having me.
Linda Ronstadt's memoir, Simple Dreams, will be out in paperback in September.
If he should ask you, but he won't, I know, 'cause it's all over and forgotten. Just tell him I said hello.
The jazz drummer Jack DeJohnette seems like he should be resting on his laurels by now. He's in his 70s. He's played on more than 200 albums with his own bands and alongside all the jazz superstars, Miles Davis, John Coltrane, Sonny Rollins, Keith Jarrett. But he's still touring all the time and releasing albums pretty regularly. Dejanet has a pretty fair claim on being the greatest living jazz drummer, but what he really wanted to do was play piano.
Fats Domino came out with a string of hits, like at Blueberry Hill, and he played this New Orleans piano, like, and so I started to learn how to play piano from the rock and roll tunes. I started working a lot around Chicago with piano trios, accompanying singers, have my own quintet. So I got quite a name for myself as a pianist in Chicago.
Then he heard a record by Ahmad Jamal, a 1958 album called But Not For Me. It was Jamal's piano playing that drew him in, but what really entranced him was the drummer, Vernell Fournier, the way he used brushes.
You know, brushes, they're another form of stick, but it uses like metal wires and a sort of a rod that pushes them out through a tubular cylinder. And they fan out that look like a broom, sort of like. If they open too wide, you won't get a very detailed sound. But if you pull them in a little bit, you can adjust them and make them thin so you can get more precise attack on them. And that's what Vernell did. On Music, 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 his brushwork is just smooth. He's from New Orleans, so, you know, he really had an impeccable touch on the instrument, a deep sense of swing and of use of time and space. You know, he wasn't flashy, but played with purpose. And it's so relaxed, although it's very fast, but it's smooth, sophisticated. You know, it's like painting, you know. So I ran out and got me a set of brushes. And this was before I had a set of drums. I discovered that if you take an album cover and play brushes on them, they made this nice, nice, high-pitched swish sound that you would get on a snare hit. So I started playing drums and practicing them every day, 3-4 hours a day, and then practicing the piano. And I'd go to sessions, the club called McKee Fitchers on Cottage Grove in Chicago. Of course, I was there every night to see Coltrane and Elvin and Jimmy Garrison. And one night, Elvin didn't return for the last set. The place was packed. So McKee says to John, he says, hey, listen, let Jack DeJohnette play the last set. The place is packed and, you know, it's just getting late. And he's a good drummer. He plays the sessions. And Coltrane just nodded his head. He didn't say, who's this guy? I don't know. Can he play? I went up and played four tunes with Coltrane. And it hit me clearly like a bolt of lightning. Like, oh, drums is what I'm going to do. This is what I'm going to make my instrument. You know, the feeling of being able to create on any instrument is it's a hard to describe feeling of satisfaction and joy. I'll be 69 this year, but I find that my passion hasn't waned. And if anything, it's got stronger. I feel like a kid.
The drummer Jack DeJohnette. He's playing at the Albany Riverfront Jazz Festival next week, and this fall he'll appear in Chicago and in Europe. Michael Raphael produced our story back in 2012. Has any record ever changed the course of your life? Or a novel or a movie or painting? Tell us your aha moment, and maybe we'll get your story on the air as well. Leave a comment at studio360.org. Next up, the protagonist in the latest James McBride novel is a young enslaved boy who wears a dress and finds power in spirituals.
He would sing a song, these big, mean, six-gun shooting pro-slavers would bust into tears and, you know, ask for their ma and stuff like that.
And James McBride will play those songs with his gospel quintet here in the studio. That is all ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. James McBride is African-American and grew up in a large, poor family run by his mother. His white mother, who was the daughter of an Orthodox rabbi, who became an intensely Christian woman. McBride's memoir, The Color of Water, A Black Man's Tribute to His White Mother, spent 2 years on the bestseller list. But a long time before he was writing books, McBride was a successful jazz musician, touring, writing songs for the likes of Anita Baker. He's also made movies with Spike Lee. His most recent novel, The Good Lord Bird, comes out in paperback this month. It combines music and religious lunacy, and it is probably the funniest book you'll ever read about slavery. It tells the story of an enslaved child who gets caught up with John Brown's gang of abolitionists in the 1850s. I spoke with McBride last year when he was touring the country with his gospel quintet, the Good Lord Bird Band, and he had just won the National Book Award. James McBride and the Good Lord Bird Band. Hey, good cross-promotional branding. Welcome to Studio 360.
Well, thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Congratulations on this award, first of all.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a nice little ride for me. I went up there with my napkin in my hand. I was eating my apple tart, and then they announced the
not book. Thomas Pynchon, not George Saunders, not Jhumpa Lahiri, but James McBride.
Good old James McBride. What do you think? Old Baldy.
And you've never won anything, maybe, a prize, but you've had a pretty charmed writing life. I mean, your first book, this huge bestseller, your first novel gets made into a big movie. This one wins this big award. I mean, you're batting a high average.
Well, I've been blessed. That's certainly, I mean, that's one way of saying it. And I'm sure, you know, when baseball players say, they say, how'd you hit the home run? And the guy goes, I've been blessed. And the guy goes, yeah, but, you know, what happened was it was a high hanging curve. But the fact is, you know, I've worked very hard at my craft. I'm 56. I've been in it a long time. I'm very conscious about the quality of my work as opposed to the volume, so mm-hmm. I don't turn out a lot of books, but I try to produce books that I would read myself.
Were you always hankering to write and publish?
No, not at all. I mean, I was when I did The Color of Water, I was working as a musician. I wrote that book in you know, in buses and vans and, you know, wherever I was, you know. But when I was, I guess it was in my early 30s, I had to figure out who my mother was, and I realized I couldn't figure out who I was until I figured out who she was. And since she never talked about her past at all, I had to go find that out.
And your mother, she's like a fictional character. Polish-Jewish rabbi's daughter comes to America, marries a black guy in the 1940s, raises these 12 children, sends them all to college. I mean, it's just...
Well, I mean, it's unbelievable, but, you know, we weren't deprived. You know, we were happy.
Yeah.
You know, we weren't like a bunch of mulattoes staggering through life trying to decide whether to, you know, eat matzo balls or fried chicken. You know? We were happy people, you know. So.
Well, and in New York, you can eat matzo balls and fried chicken.
Yeah, we couldn't. We were lucky with just to get the fried chicken. And yeah. If the matzo balls were there, we'd ate them too. You know, I mean, I used to have a guidance counselor who used to say, you know, you're looking for something. You're looking for something. And I'd say to myself, yes, I am. Food.
I want to talk about your new award-winning book, The Good Lord Bird. The story is told in the voice of a 12-year-old slave named Henry Shackelford. John Brown takes him in thinking he's a 12-year-old girl and starts calling him Little Onion. Would you read from the moment when Onion and John Brown have their first real interaction? They've just escaped the Kansas town where Onion's father has been accidentally killed, and Brown's trying to comfort the little boy, whom he thinks is a little girl, with the various knickknacks in his pockets.
Okay. Be delighted to read with my trusty assistant, Adam Falk, on piano. Come on, man. I'm sorry. All right. Here, the old man produced the last from his pocket an odd, long, black and white feather, and throw the feather in my head, tucked it right in my curly napped hair, then paused a moment, reflecting, staring at that feather in my head. "Feather of a good lord bird," he said. "Now that's special. I don't feel bad about it neither, giving my special thing to you. The Bible says, take that which is special from thine own hand and giveth to the needy, and you moveth in the Lord's path. That's the secret, little onion. But just so you know, you ought not to believe too much in heathen things, and don't stretch the great ruler's word too much. You stretch it here, stretch it there. Before you know it, it's full out devilment. We being fighters of his righteous holy word, we is allowed a few indulgences, like charms and so forth. But we ought not to take too much advantage. You understand?" Well, I didn't know what the hell he was talking about, but being that he was a lunatic, I nodded my head, yes.
That was James McBride reading from The Good Lord Bird, accompanied on piano by Adam Falk. So what made you want to write a novel starring John Brown and this fictional kid?
Well, many books have been written about him, but I wanted to write a book that people like me would read. Books that are written about, like during slave time, that are written about people who were crusaders for freedom. I mean, these people, it's that, like, these people never went to the bathroom or anything. They never smelled. They didn't have to brush their teeth. And those kinds of books where, you know, with the thunder from the sky is coming, you know, they're not realistic.
This people smell here. there's a lot of grit and down dirty stuff in this book. The other thing that books about slavery and John Brown and the lead up to the Civil War aren't is funny, which this regularly is. It's not exclusively a comic novel, but it's, as we heard there, this has a sense of humor.
Well, yeah. I mean, I come from a funny family, and I think I like to laugh, and I like to read stuff that makes me laugh. And I don't want to write a book that's depressing. And, you know, books cost a lot of money. You know, you want to – if people are going to invest that kind of money in your work, they should at least be moved to some semblance of happiness, even if briefly.
Onion, this kid, provides a lot of comic relief throughout the book. But he's not totally charming. He is stubborn. He can be obnoxious. He doesn't want to work hard if he can avoid it. Where did you get this character and this voice?
Well, I mean, you just described me. So maybe you know, there's some parts of me in there. I just liked the fact that this character is filled with ambivalence, doesn't really want to be free, is happy where he was.
His slave master.
He had a good relationship with his slave master, had a nice warm bed to sleep in, got all he wanted to eat and so forth. And didn't really know any better. And unfortunately, I'm sure there were many, many blacks who were like that. Now, that doesn't mean they didn't wake up thinking of freedom. But all of us wake up thinking of winning the lottery or, you know, quitting our job. It doesn't mean we're going to do it.
Yeah. Now, the fact that everybody thinks he's a girl and he dresses as a girl provides a lot of some like it hot comedy. But what made you decide to have this gender confusion?
Well, first of all, I didn't feel I was good enough to write about a real girl. The other part was that him having to play a girl just created a lot of comical situations. And I, you know, if it was one thing that writers talk about when the mic's not on is they talk about sex and all those nasty things they're not supposed to be talking about. And so I just thought it was funny to kind of find some blue material to get. And I thought this would really be a good way to play with that within the framework of this story.
Mm-hmm. One of his charming parts, this kid, is that he sings a lot and he can't wait to break into song. Again, like you, I guess. I mean, you're a musician. Was that fun, making up his music?
Yes, indeed it was. And the effect of music on the pro-slavers in particular was always something I really liked, because he would sing a song and these big, mean, six-gun shooting, you know, pro-slavers would bust into tears and, you know, ask for their ma and stuff like that.
Well, on that note, talking about music, should we have some music? Will you play?
Of course.
What are you going to play?
This song is called Cinnamon.
Cinnamon.
Where you going to run to?
Where you going to run to?
Where you going to run to?
send a man.
Where you gonna run to?
Judgment Day.
Judgment Day.
Send a man.
Where you gonna run to?
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 Judgment Day.
Judgment Day.
After a while.
After a while.
It'll all be over.
All be over.
After a while.
After a while.
The sun will shine.
Sun will shine.
The trees and the trees will be burned. You better run to the sea and the sea will be boiling. You better run to the trees and the trees will be burning. Who are you gonna run to?
Where you gonna run to?
Oh, judgment day.
That was James McBride and the Good Lord Bird Band playing Sinner Man. James McBride on saxophone, Keith Robinson on guitar, Trevor Exter on bass, Adam Falk on piano, and Showtime Brooks on drums. Now, The Good Lord Bird, the book, is about this time and this man, John Brown, in the 1850s, but it's also very much about the music of the era. What was it, the spiritual music that led you to John Brown?
No. That occurred after. Because one of the things that was really interesting about John Brown was that he was deeply religious. And he was seen as a nut. You know, he's still seen as a nut.
Yeah, and you don't portray him as not a nut entirely.
Yes, well, he was kind of nutty. Yes, indeed. but he was powered by his sense of religiosity, by his sense of religion.
As abolitionism so widely was.
And I'm glad it was.
Yeah.
And that religion is powered by music.
The Good Lord Bird has a lot of deeply pious religious characters like John Brown, but also some sinners. Some of those sinners are redeemable. But then there's Frederick Douglass, who is not depicted as the saintly figure we know from history, but as this pervy, pompous drunk. I wouldn't be surprised if you're getting some negative reaction to that depiction.
Yeah, I've gotten a little bit of backlash about that. I mean, it's a book of caricature. So if people want to read about the real Frederick Douglass, they're welcome to read another book.
Right.
But it's true, and I should point out that Frederick Douglass did have a black wife and a white mistress, and they lived in the same house at the same time. Frederick Douglass was a friend of John Brown, and John Brown did ask him to come to Harper's Ferry with him, and Frederick Douglass said, I'm sorry, that I will not do. But he did, you know, he physically and literally fought against slavery. But he was also a man who, like me, would not have done it. I would not have gone with John Brown during that time. I just don't have the heart. You know, the 19 men who did were unconsciously brave. You know, 15 white guys and the four black guys, you have to remember that they must have been just out of their minds. Because when you read the accounts of what happened to these fellas, it breaks your heart, and also it makes you admire what this country is capable of. America, we do a lot of things wrong, but we do more things right. And I think John Brown and his band of men are indications of this. They're proof of that.
James McBride and the Good Lord Bird Band, thank you all for being here today. And before I let you go altogether, will you play us out? End the show?
Yeah, we're gonna play out with some jam. All right.
I actually spoke with James McBride for the better part of an hour, and you can hear that whole conversation plus another song from the Good Lord Bird Band at studio360.org. That's it for today's show. Thank you very much for listening. You can keep up with us every day online on Twitter. We're at Studio360Show. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Ital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramasvaram,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Shruti Panamaneni,
Ariel Roland Wang,
Marshall Bright,
Hannah Alonji.
And thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music's by David Van Tiefen.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, I'll talk with style maven and Broadway star Tavi Gevinson. She's only 18, but she's been field-tested by junior high.
In seventh grade, like, for as much as it sometimes stung to be kind of bullied, it was also kind of like, yeah, bring it on.
That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.